Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Louisa. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in a library, yeah, standing there behind the counter, willing to help.
Kia ora from Karen, readers and listeners. Today I'm chatting with a very special guest, writer Joanne Drayton. Kia ora, Joanne.
Kia ora.
Joanne is an acclaimed literary biographer. Her book, The Search for Anne Perry, about the later life of one of the two Christchurch schoolgirl killers who are popularly known as the Heavenly Creatures from the title of Peter Jackson's movie about them, it was actually a phrase that they used about themselves, was a New Zealand Book Awards finalist and made it into the top 10 of the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list. But it was only the last in a long line of prestigious titles, which also include Nyomar, Her Life in Crime, written with the help of a National Library Fellowship. Hurrah again. A wonderful book about New Zealand's own Queen of Crimes, up there with Agatha Christie and Dorothy Sayers, and biographies of the artists Frances Hodgkins and Edith Collier, her study of whom earned her a PhD in art history. Joanne, in fact, has worked as an art curator and published on art and design theory, as well as her writing career. So I thought I'd start by asking you, Joanne, so we use the phrase literary biographer. What are the hallmarks of a literary biographer?
I think people like the idea of literary because it sounds important.
Surely not just that.
Well, it puts it up there. You yeah. know, and I mean, there are things about a literary biography that mark it, I guess, from others. But in a way, I like to see all biography as valid. And I always think that literary biography is often about significant figures. The great figures like Frances Hodgkins, Nia Marsh, and the infamous, in a way, in terms of Anne Perry, mm-hmm. Juliet Hume. So I think it has that significance, that importance. But I think that it potentially, and there is the idea that it has to be robust.
Mm-hmm.
It has to have that sort of absolute guarantee that that what's there is as accurate as you can make it. And
To be taken seriously.
It is to be taken seriously, and those careers are to be taken seriously. But I also have that kind of democratic sense.
Yes.
That in every life there's things to learn.
Yeah.
And I think that's what biography is. It's a way that we look at our life and our own life. We explore So I think, I always think that every biography potentially is literary.
It's similar to what we say about fiction. It's exactly the same. We have literary fiction, which generally implies, it's not going to be predictable. It might be a little more complex, might take a little more attention. But basically, we don't want to say that there's anything wrong with any kind of fiction. People are reading it and enjoying it, and it all has to be enjoyed, because if it isn't, what's the point of writing it? It all has to take people somewhere.
Yeah.
And different people at different times want to go on different voyages.
Yeah, they do. And it's that learning, it's what you take from it. And I think potentially those important lives, we expect to take much more from them.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not necessarily the outcome. So
And therein also lies perhaps the skill of the biographer as well as the subjects.
Yeah.
But still keeping on to this choosing of the subjects, how have you chosen your subjects for your biographies? Has there been a leitmotif here?
I think through every biography, you explore an aspect of yourself. I know that sounds terribly sort of self-centered in a way, but even narcissistic.
Not at all. No, I think it sounds like what you're going to get in your hands is going to be something written with heart.
In a way, and I think the way that I think I always explored something of my own experience in those biographies. I loved art, and, mm-hmm. and I still do. You know, obviously, I'm now teaching English, but I'm not in the art scene as much as I was before, but I loved art, mm-hmm. And I found in those lives and that art something spectacular, something mm-hmm. amazing, something that I really, that fed my soul.
Mm-hmm.
And so I my first three subjects were painters, mm-hmm. and they were women. And it was a woman's experience of painting and a woman's experience of life. And also I loved the fact that these were women who had an ambiguous sexuality. Mm-hmm. They had interesting lives, adventurous mm-hmm. lives. So in those lives, I found something of myself,
mm-hmm.
and I explored maybe my life in a different time, in a different context, or in a different world, or aspects of it. And I guess it's yourself that you're looking to find something of in those stories. And I think that's the same with the reader. The reader's looking for something of their own life echoed and mm-hmm. Reflected back for them.
Yeah, so those components of ambiguity and nonconformity are important in that sense, that people who came before you and in which you recognize a, I'm not going to say outsider, but in a way, almost want to.
I think they are. I mean, in a way, the artist sits outside the world and observes it. The writer observes it. Yeah. The painter observes it. They are kind of outsiders, and they're peripheral, because we've always stuck our creativity on the margin of, you know, of the world and life, and so they are outsiders, and they have that distance and that distillation of vision, I think. So I they were fascinating, and by the time I'd finished Frances Hodgkins, which I just adored, because it's just such an adventure. I mean, you follow their footsteps, so you have this privilege of walking through a world which has moved in time and changed in circumstance, but is the world that they walked in. I always go to the places, I always see the work, I always experience something of what they've experienced. So then I kind of indulged my passion for murder.
Yeah. True crime, as we call it in libraries.
Well, initially not true crime. It's not so much, because I wrote Naya Marsh first.
Yeah.
So I looked at the form of the cozy, and I'm right into kind of nostalgia, that
vintage,
sort of
vintage,
retrospective sort of retro kind of stories. And I was breastfeeding my son, you know, and I would have a Naya Marsh book, like. It was all those sort of experiences that you go through that are kind of where you read a book. You know, an odd one.
And the book remains forever linked to that experience you had while you were reading it, yeah.
And so I just wanted to read something I could pick up, put down, kind of intrigued me, and that I maybe want to turn the page, because it was a bit of a page turner. And also because Naya Marsh was born in Christchurch.
As were Juliet Hume and Pauline Parker, that you were going to, you were just about to say, and when you were interested in them as crime, and you said, no, not true crime.
Yeah.
But that is a true crime.
They were truly criminals,
although with circumstances that you explore in the book.
Yeah, I think I moved from the cozy to the very cold.
This is so hard to say. Cold reality.
Yeah.
It was what I started to think when you said cold. Is she going to say cold blooded? But you can't. I don't feel you can use cold blooded about what happened.
It's a cold reality, I think, and it's a harsh thing. And I moved to that because I found Noam. I read in somewhere in Noam Marsh's papers that she had some great compassion, some real understanding of those girls, because she was alive. She was alive and probably very much aware, I would say. Because, I mean, imagine Christchurch, it's like a fishbowl in terms of the, you know, a small 1950s population in New Zealand. And it was, of course, Juliet Hume's father was the rector of Christchurch University or Christchurch College University. So I mean, it was just huge, And so, that was a personal choice. It was interesting because my mother went to school with the girls. That was the backstory to my life. And when I finished with Naya Marsh, I didn't want her to finish. And I was going, what am I going to do next?
Cast about. You were casting about. And this that had been always perhaps in the back of your mind already.
Yeah,
reinforced by that. It's interesting, the thing about the... talking about, you know, cold-blooded killers and not cold-blooded. I was rereading the Ann Perry biography in preparation for our talk today. And it's not really a biography, in fact. It's biography, I feel, is the wrong term. It is about the search for Ann Perry. Exactly.
Yeah.
Both
yeah.
her own and those of in yours, looking for her, following her own search. But one of the things, I hadn't remembered this, just made such an effect on me, was when you say that when she was in prison at Mount Eden after she'd been sentenced, that she watched 5 men be executed while she was there. And this, we're talking about, how old was she?
She was 15 when she
went, when the crime was committed. When, so it might have been 16 when that, you know, through those years. She was there for 5 years.
Yes.
To watch as a young teenager, to be in a place with watching men being taken out and hearing, so you can hear the sounds. I don't know if I want to think about what sounds she was hearing, but it really, really brought home to me the dramaticity that it's so easy to say, you know, true crime and give a little laugh, but it is actually, it's just something that is almost unimaginable. I think it is unimaginable. You do a good job, though.
Yeah.
Those things like that, the little pictures like that are really important. So, speaking of immersing yourself, so picking scenes like that and how you immerse us in the story that you're telling, I also wanted to ask about, so one of the things that I enjoy about your books is your own immersion into the life and personality of your subject. And I notice, it seems to me, that it carries over somewhat into the format and the tone of the books themselves. For instance, in your Naya Marsh biography, now, I'm not sure if everyone is aware out there, all of our listeners, that besides being a queen of crime writers, Naya Marsh was also heavily involved in the theater as a stage director. And the Naya Marsh biography is laid out as if it's a play, as if each chapter is the opening of a new scene, and there's a few lines that create a backdrop, and then you get into the story of that chapter. And likewise, The Search for Ann Perry has a format which is also very striking, but very different, and it's one which uses a cutting back and forth between two lives. So there's Ann's life leading up to the crime and Ann's life after the crime. And it seemed to underline to me the disjointedness that Ann Perry herself must feel when she looks at her life, or what are actually two lives in some ways. So is this something you consciously work towards, choosing the right format, or does it come while you're writing?
Oh,
or am I completely wrong and it doesn't happen?
No. You're absolutely right. Actually, it's funny. It's sort of an instinctive thing. So in some ways... it's really great to have someone reflect what you're doing back to you, because in some ways you do think about some aspects of it, but there is also that sense of you embrace that person, that life, that narrative, that story, and you've got all this information, and how do you actually start that first sentence?
Yeah.
And the only way to begin, in a way, is to have a sense of how you will approach it, and the structure, I think, how that structure tells that story. I'm a great structuralist in a way, because I think, and I've always tried to push the form. I don't know whether this is, I've always tried to push the biographical form, because I came from an academic tradition and background, and so I was always looking to how I could make it different, to give a different experience. What boundary could I push back? What thing could I do to challenge it, to actually tell a slightly different kind of story? And so I actually, each time I sit down with a new subject and I think, what can I do that's going to be different with this? What toes can I stand on, you know? Because obviously it does upset people, because in some ways it's not the form they were expecting necessarily. But yeah, they do. With Ann Perry, what happened was I had done a lot of research and I'd read, oh my God, so many of those books. There were so many Hanbury books. I lost some of my vision reading them. But I was well into it, and I was sitting waiting to catch a plane in Wellington Airport, and I had this huge bowl of coffee, you know, like my massive latte.
Yeah, the large latte which you had this morning.
Exactly. And I was sitting there, and I had this amazing idea. Well, I thought it was amazing, and I thought, yep, that'll tell that story really well, and it'll make people understand her.
Yeah.
It'll invite people to know her rather than, because you can imagine if you do something at 15, the rest of the life it's sort of, how do you live on past that? You know,
is the rest an anti-climax or is it not?
Yeah. How do you read on past that actually as well? So I was sitting there and I grabbed like paper napkins. I sketched out. You know, I'm very visual because it was a quite diagrammatic thing. And I did it twice, two different napkins, two different occasions. The first was a rough sketch. The second was more refined, but there were lots of sticks and not many words. And I said, on the second time my partner was there, and I said, look, what do you think? Is this great? With just a whole lot of lines on a napkin. Yeah. And I said, what do you think? This is going to be fantastic, isn't it? And I think she kind of looked at it as if it was, you know, tic-tac-toe or something. I don't know.
Quantum physics.
So then what happened was I stuck them somewhere because I thought, no, they're going to be really important sometime, maybe. Maybe they won't. I wasn't sure. I hadn't actually absolutely decided that was what was going to happen. So then I come to actually, sort of beginning to write, and I think, where are those napkins? And I'm like, I just tore my whole office apart. And when I found it, I thought, yeah, I sort of did have it in my mind, but it did help me. In that moment, I had more detail, I had more clarity. Probably it was the latte, I think. And the idea of waiting for a plane, I love that moment.
It's actually interesting. There's an Italian author who dedicated one of her books to British Airlines. And I saw this in the front, and it said, you know, to British Airlines, it says flight such and such, airport of Palermo. And I thought, well, I've got to investigate this. I'm fascinated by book dedications. And she had the idea, the vision for her first book had come to her while waiting for a delayed British Airways flight. In the airport, seeing the airplanes take off and land, there could be something intellectually stimulating about this. You know, we touch down, we take off. There must be some kind of energy coming out of that.
Well, Robert Louis Stevenson wrote about, you know, the affair is to move, to travel.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a great traveller. I think movement through the world. I mean, that's how the last two books I've written while I was walking. So I think, and they have a pace that my previous books, I think, didn't have, because I think how you write something has a lot, not only the structure, but how you write something has a lot to do with, you know, how it comes out. And
I had noticed that as well in the Ann Perry book, that it's very, it really pulls you along. It's got quite a pace, trots right along. So in this, how many years did you, when you say, you know, I was reading all the books, so from cover to cover, all the books, plus all the original material you must have found in archives and microfiche of newspapers at the time. So how much time goes into preparing a biography for you?
Well,
it'd be different for everyone.
Oh, well, I would say, 3 to 5 years. I think probably I cogitate those ideas and sort of fiddle around with that topic or that subject rather for quite a long time before I actually get in there.
It's simmering on the back burner, even if you're not at that moment writing it. You're already aware that you will be writing it.
There's a sense of destiny, you know. And it plays through your mind and it keeps coming up. With Ann Perry, it was interesting. My mother kept on sending me, when I'd given up the idea, I did give up the idea, she kept sending me articles from, you know, the Christchurch newspapers, anything about Anne, anything about anything to do with the Parker Hume thing, which does come up in Christchurch. And she'd send it to me, and I think, well, I wish she'd stop. Because I wish she'd stop.
Like being hassled.
It was sort of like, I've given this up. I'm defeated by it, you know.
Yeah.
And it was sort of, it was just played on. And so I think the research takes a good chunk, but You know, I think the research is probably 3 years, but
yeah.
And the writing, anything between 6 months and a year.
Yeah.
I think it's very hard to write something less than that. But it depends on what opportunities you've had. Because I started the last book that I've just, well, the book that is not part and not out yet, but
which we will talk about.
Yeah,
later.
We will. Yeah, but with Naomi Marsh, I had the National Library Fellowship.
Yeah.
So I had a year off.
Yeah.
A year off work, and we moved down to Wellington, and and the interesting thing is that biography becomes your life. So
yeah.
It's a strange...
It's very fervid. It's a very fervid art, I would say.
Yeah.
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 If you're a people person, and you clearly are.
I am.
Shouldn't probably be a biography if you're not a people person. But it's interesting when you say about how long it took in the National Library Fellowship. So the book proposal is a very important for all you would-be biographers out there.
Yeah.
You might want to think about the book, what's going to happen with your book proposal. And I actually, one of the parts I love, and I was rereading The Search for Ann Perry, was about when you talk about sending to her publisher in your attempt to be able to speak with her and meet her, which she was reluctant to do at the beginning. You sent to her publisher a copy of the proposal you had made to HarperCollins for the book. And you quote the concluding paragraph of the proposal, and I want to read it because I found that it really illuminated the biographer's art, and it really gave you know, how that your ability to give the world a chance to see into the private lives of others is something more than just satisfying a taste for the prurient or for gossip, that it's actually a much finer and more important art. And the final paragraph reads like this. It is amazing to have discovered a voice for Juliet Hume in the writing of Ann Perry, and New Zealand needs to listen. It is time to move out of the 1950s, the details of which have been frozen in time and ground over long enough. In today's context, this is punitive and embarrassing. Ann Perry's life story needs to grow, to leave behind the terrible mistake of a young teenager, and mature to acknowledge the remarkable adult contribution and achievements of one of the world's most well-known crime doyens. And I felt that your book really fulfilled, this was a challenge you had set yourself, and that it really fulfilled this. The final paragraph of the book is another case, as a case of writing, I would call it genius. I'm going to put it right out there. I don't want to read it because I think that each reader needs to encounter it in the context of the book, and they need to have read the whole book for it to get make its full impact. But it makes a connection for us between Ann Perry's need to express herself and her need for resolution. Mm-hmm. And the medium of crime fiction. So I'm just going to quote a piece from Louis Menand, who writes about biographies, wrote a piece about the biographies in the New Yorker, and he said, a biography is a tool for imagining another person to be used along with other tools. It is not a window or a mirror. Does that mean something to you? Is that,
that's lovely. Yeah. It's just beautiful. It's beautifully expressed. And I think it's true. I think that the biographer takes you on a journey. But a good biography leaves a lot of open spaces for you to inhabit and to bring your imagination to bear, you know, and also some of your own conclusions.
Yeah.
Because there are lots of things that will remain. Anybody that thinks they've got the answers to everything in any biography is a fool. Because a good biography accepts and acknowledges questions. It's open to grey, not 50 shades of grey, but you know.
Possibly 100 shades of different kinds of grey. You know, it's really interesting you should say that about 50 shades of grey, because it brings us back to the question at the beginning. We've come a circle, you know, the literary biography and the literary fiction as opposed to, say, commercial fiction or genre fiction.
Yeah.
There is that leaving points open. It doesn't necessarily, one of the major distinctions is that it doesn't have a resolution at the end. Much modern literary fiction doesn't give you that resolution.
Because we know that that's not life.
Yes,
I mean, postmodernism has kind of introduced us to the part of the elephant we're looking at. And, you know, I mean, we understand life in a more, well, we understand telling a narrative in a more complex mm-hmm. way. We allow it to be much more of a matrix than, yep. than a linear kind of, and that's what my books, I do attempt as well, to create some of that matrix, some of that complexity in which the reader needs to find their own answers, find their own way through it. And I mean, that's been one of the challenges of writing these. And that's what I do have, I guess everybody has their mission statement. Yeah. Because in a way, I wanted to do that. But had I, in a way that was a proposal, had I found someone different to that.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Had I found someone I couldn't.
Fit into that box.
Yeah.
It would have been a different.
I would have written a different. And I mean, I would have, no holds barred because.
Yeah.
You have to, one of the basic things is you have to be honest.
Yeah.
You have to have integrity and you have to tell a story as you see it.
Yeah.
And I think at the end of the day, if you can't do that, you need to choose another subject.
Yeah. Well, a writer that I am fascinated with and impressed with, Ta-Nehisi Coates, the American writer, who's famous for his memoirs about, which particularly touch on race relations in America. And someone asked him what makes a good memoir. And he said, to write a good memoir, you cannot fucking lie. Which leads us into my final question. We do have a few minutes left. And I wanted to hear what you're working on now, because I believe there is a bit of a memoir theme in there.
Well, yeah,
one of them.
Yeah, now I've got two things.
Yeah.
Interestingly, I think I've written more in the last 4 years than I've ever written. So, so that's, I don't know how that happened, but I have.
You're obviously in your prime.
Oh,
yes.
Well, I feel, in a way, I think the biographer's art is about maturity. And I think
yes.
you do mature, and I think you can get better. There's some things I always say to my partner, you know, that there are some things that you actually age is an advantage for. I think and
absolutely
writing
yeah.
is one of those things, particularly if you're looking at life and you want bring perspective to it, which
yes.
is something
well said.
But you know, I started going to be a kind of memoir, but again, I was going to move that form into, I have this fictional thread that runs through it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not quite sure now exactly what I would call it a biographical fiction, actually,
mm-hmm.
because I think there is a fictional element. It's quite clear what it is. It's a story that's told that I imagine.
Mm-hmm.
So not only are you looking at my life, but the imaginations, the imaginings that I have as well,
yeah.
which in a memoir often doesn't quite afford. So it's a complex layered thing,
mm-hmm.
and I've loved writing it. I didn't have a contract for it, and I thought, what am I going to write that just pleases me? And
yeah.
I thought, I'm going to write this because
I've earned the right to tell
yeah.
this.
I know what I'm doing.
And the other one?
And the other one is Hudson and Hawks.
So,
yeah, no, this is very exciting.
Yeah.
And this is the one closest
very
to...
Very new news,
yes.
I think, yeah.
It's closest to... It's just about there. So it's due to be to come out in October. So
this year.
Very exciting, yeah. Yeah, and it's been a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful journey. And the things you learn, you know, the experience
yeah.
of walking with these guys.
Yeah.
And it's just been fantastic.
Yeah, I think we're
wonderful.
Really, I think New Zealand is going to be looking forward to that. And probably this is going to bring New Zealand to the rest of the world because it sounds like a universally appealing biography. So that would be wonderful. We'll be looking forward to it. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
It's been lovely chatting with you. I wish we had twice the amount of time.
Me too.
So that's Joanne Drayton.
Thank you.
We're thanking her again. Ka kite anō. Was brought to you by Auckland Libraries. Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM. or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/booksandbeyond.